We want to talk today about this matter of economics. And as I was sharing with Dr. Moore, I've pondered many times and continue to ponder, why did God create His creation the way He did, where economics is so important? I understand why biology is so important, why, you know, we have to eat to nourish our bodies and why there has to be reproduction so that species continue and so on. But why did He make economics so important? You say, what do you mean? If you are involved in any kind of ministry, I'm sure that sometime you have said, if we just had the money to do this. Have you ever encountered that? Maybe the Lord provides so abundantly you've never encountered that. But that question arises. And when I listen to the news about the political campaigns, what's the big question? How many million dollars has the candidate raised? Money is so important. Jesus spoke frequently about money, and I think it's significant. And when He talked about the impossibility of divided loyalty, it was money that was the competitor that He used as the example, the competitor for loyalty to God. Now the question is, as we seek to do our theology, can we learn anything from economics? And I want to re-emphasize that our theology is based upon God's revealed Word. But as we do our theology, as we formulate it, as we express it, as we communicate it, we are human beings doing that. Now the aim is to have our theology as thoroughly biblical and divinely inspired or divinely infilled as possible, and for our human personalities and wants and inclinations and biases to have as small a part as possible. The behavioral sciences tell us something about how human beings work. And to me, economics is one of the most interesting of those, because in economics you could see sometimes the most clearly and starkly displayed the way in which human beings function, because this is so basic a part of our life. There are several things that we can learn in the doing of theology instructionally from the study of economics. And the first is this: the reality of globalization. There was a time, as little as 200 years ago, when your community was defined quite narrowly geographically. In fact, basically the community was bounded by the distance from which you could hear the church bell. And you lived within that rather narrowly defined community. You probably married someone from within that distance. You received the food that you ate. It was grown within that radius. If you sold something, you probably sold it to someone within that radius. If you bought something, you probably bought something that was manufactured within that area. So it was a rather small kind of a community. But that began to change. Living when we do now, it is hard for us to realize the tremendous impact that was made upon community by the development of the railroad. Now you see things manufactured elsewhere could be readily transported here, and people could go elsewhere in fashion that wasn't possible before. And community began to expand. Now, there was still the resistance to the expansion of that community. And I look at immigration in our country today, and I say to myself, things haven't changed so terribly much. Because communities tend to try to remain sort of homogeneous. And I remember living in the city of Chicago, and sometimes you stepped across the street, and it was like you'd gone from one country to another country. They were speaking Polish over here, and they were speaking Swedish over here. They had the same money, at least. But it was like a different country. A couple of years ago, my son-in-law ran in the New York Marathon. It's so laid out that you run through all the boroughs of New York City. He said it was like going from one country to the next. It was obvious that these were different cultural communities. And there's a small community, it will be the place of our address in a couple of months, which became the doctoral dissertation for a professor at the University of Wisconsin. He entitled it, A Community Transplanted, in which a little community called Rättvik in the Dalarna province of Sweden almost totally moved to the United States, and the population formed the town of Cambridge in Isani County, Minnesota. The interesting thing was, if people lived northeast of town in Sweden, they settled northeast of town in Minnesota. So sometimes you had the same neighbors on both sides that you had back in Sweden. Now, the geography and the climate of Dalarna Province, Sweden, and Isani County, Minnesota, are very similar. And since the language was still being spoken the same, all you had to do was build a house on the same style of architecture as you had in Sweden, and it was like you'd never left home. When I hear the debates about, multilingual education and about whether we should have English as the official language and so on, I realize that the same dynamics are at work. But the world has changed, whether we realize it and whether we are willing to admit it or not. It has changed, and it's changed greatly. The breakdown of isolationism. There was a time back, as recently as the 1930s, where there was political isolation. And Charles Lindbergh was one of the most outspoken advocates of this. We are going to stay out of that war over in Europe. That's their war. We're not going to get involved there again. And it was interesting that the model was sort of that of the medieval fortress, in which you had a moat around your castle so no one could come across that moat. We had two big moats, one called the Atlantic Moat and the other one called the Pacific Moat, and we were safe behind that. But times had changed, and we quickly found out. Now, it is not just politically and militarily that these things have changed. Economically, things have changed as well. One of the items on the news this morning was that OPEC has announced it's not going to increase its production of petroleum. Oil went to $105 a barrel. We are no longer free to determine such things as the price of gas. No matter what some politicians may tell you, these things are out of the control of us in many cases. And sometimes our presidents, even in recent history, have had to learn this the hard way. During his administration, President Clinton tried to urge the Japanese to open their markets more to imports from the United States. The Japanese, in a very tactful and indirect fashion, observed that perhaps they would not purchase in the future as much as of our United States Treasury securities as they had in the past. The talk about opening their markets was quickly eliminated. Along came President George W. Bush, who is a Texan. And as a Texan said, we are going to increase the tariffs, import tariffs on steel to protect our steel industry. We don't want steel coming from Europe, for example. The Europeans were very shrewd. They got out the U.S. electoral map and they said, George Bush has another election to run in the year 2004. What are the states he needs to carry that? He needs North Carolina and he needs South Carolina. We will only raise our import tariffs on textiles. And George Bush had to drop the increased import tariffs on steel, much to the chagrin of the United Steelworkers Union. You see, we live in a world in which everything's all interlocked these days. We're talking about energy sufficiency and independence. It'll take a long time, but we need to move in that direction. But it's not only true economically. That's the reality of the world we live in. There was a time when we in the United States and earlier those in Europe were the sending nations as far as missionaries. That was we exported our version, our Western understanding of Christianity. Now, I remember one time being shown the picture of the Baptist Seminary in Buenos Aires, where I've had the privilege since of lecturing. And I said, that building looks an awful lot like a North American building. And the professor of church history at that school said to me, it ought to. It was designed in Nashville. And I have even seen little white churches with steeples in Africa. You see, very Western and North American architecture. And we've done our theology not realizing we were doing it from our North American perspective and said, this is the way it is to be. Assuming that, of course, we had all the right insights. But economically, it is not true that we are the only ones with good ideas. It was as long ago as 1976 that we stayed in a house in Sweden, and for the first time, I saw windows with two panes of glass with little narrow slit Venetian blinds between the panes of glass. It was a long time till I saw that kind of window in the United States. The last time in Japan, I noticed that when the waitress takes the order, she doesn't have to carry a paper slip back to the kitchen. She has entered it electronically, and it's already been transmitted back to the cook, and he knows what you want. Technologically, we are not the only ones with the ideas, and theologically, it's not the case either. Increasingly, the other parts of the world, the southern hemisphere and the east, where the church has a vitality that is astounding to someone coming from North America, will also be producing theology indigenous to themselves, but in ways that we can also be instructed by. For example, a church practice that reflected a piece of theology that we don't always emphasize. My wife and I attended two churches in Harare, Zimbabwe. I preached at one of the services. At the other church, a British Baptist preached, but we had the same driver, so we got to hear each other, and we got to go to two churches. And the practice was the same in both of them. In some of our churches, at least, the pastor finishes, goes to the door, the first person comes by and shakes his hand and leaves, and each person goes by, shakes the pastor's hand. It was a little different there. The first person came by, shook the pastor's hand, then stood next to the pastor. The second person came by, shook the pastor's hand, the first person's hand stood next to him. So each member of that congregation that morning shook the hand of every other member, and then we formed a circle, joined hands, sang a little benediction, went our way. I thought, what a beautiful expression of the fact of the body of Christ. And the church is not the pastor, the church is the whole body of believers. There was their theology expressed in a beautiful way. We have much to learn from a globalized church. And there are some of our ideas that may be drawn more from our American culture than from the Bible that we may need to have corrected by interaction with those who come from a very different kind of a situation. The reality of globalization. Secondly, the tendency to overemphasize our own time, this time. I think it was yesterday in question time that I expressed this term that I've used, chronocentrism. If the first point was ethnocentrism, the tendency to focus on and make normative our culture and where we live, where we are, this is chronocentrism, to sort of absolutize our time and when we are. The idea that things are different now than they've ever been before, the uniqueness of this present time. You can see it rather dramatically in the area of economics, in which in the late 1990s, the stock market rose almost perpendicularly, especially the tech stocks and the internet stocks, the dot-coms, anything that was a dot-com stock, whether it had earnings or not, shot up. Now, there were traditional ways in which stock market analysts would try to analyze the value of a stock, the relationship between the price of the stock and the earnings of the company per share. But this was a new era, and the old measures didn't count anymore. Instead of things like that, the value of the stock was based upon how many number of hits there were on the company's website. Things were different. This is a new era. The old rules don't apply anymore. And people who tried to apply the old rules were hopelessly antiquated. It's different this time, is what was said. Well, if people had had a little broader perspective, they would have found out that this wasn't the first time that it was different this time. For example, in the 1920s, there was a glamour tech stock called Radio Corporation of America, RCA. Because, you see, radio in the 1920s was sort of what iPods and such are in our time right now. That was the new glamour stock. And RCA stock in 1923 cost, for one share, $5. By 1929, adjusted for stock splits, the price had risen to $600 per share. By 1935, the price of a share of RCA was $5 per share. It was not until 1960 that the price returned to what it had been back then. Now, a person could have learned, but you see, this is different this time. The 1990s are different than the late 1920s. And the new era terminology was being used. Alan Greenspan, president of the Federal Reserve Bank, warned that this wasn't the first time that there had been a new era. In fact, he said, speaking of what he called the irrational exuberance, regrettably, history is strewn with visions of such new eras that in the end have proven to be a mirage. Well, he was ridiculed for that. He was laughed at. But if you look at the stock market today, the NASDAQ exchange, which is where tech stocks particularly are traded, is still only at about 50% of what it was in the year 2000. The idea that our age is different and everything is new and different is not the first time people have thought these ways. I did a little research on the history of the doctrine of foreknowledge. And some of you know that one recent argument has been that human freedom is incompatible with God knowing what a person's going to do in advance. This was a new and fresh idea. But I put my CD, my historical theology CD with the history of the Christian church, the documents of it, in my drive, and I did a search, several searches. And I found out that in the second century, Justin Martyr had anticipated and responded to that very argument, as had Tertullian in his response to Marcion. Celsus had raised the objection, and Origen thought it was scarcely worth responding to that old argument. Apparently, this is what drove Cicero to deny foreknowledge, which caused Augustine to respond to it. A new era? A new idea? Maybe our time is not as unique as we think. Now, it happens on some kind of practical levels. I still remember with pain a man who lived a half a block from my church in Chicago. I'd had the privilege of leading them both to the Lord, he and his wife. And then they attended regularly for a while, and then they began to miss, and they began to miss more. And I went and visited them. And the man said, "Well, I've always had problems understanding the doctrine of the Trinity." And I said, "I always have, too." But he said, "I've been attending a church front street, church over on Clark Street, where one of my co-workers attends. And they've solved the problem." And he went in the back room, brought out a little pamphlet, and I read it. And, you know, I didn't have the heart to say to him, "This is modalistic monarchianism, and the church condemned this 1,600 years ago or so." New and fresh, you see. The idea that our time is unique. The postmodernists who say this is a totally new era. A little reflection, a little memory will say that in the last couple of centuries, Romanticism, existentialism, Marxism, Freudianism, pragmatism, evolutionism, logical positivism were all thought to be revolutionary too, you see. Can we learn from the mistakes of those who lost a lot of money in the new era economically so that we do not theologically get burned the same way? The third lesson I would draw from study of economics is the effect of mass psychology, or even, I'll leave it with that particular idea. The influence of a popular development, a popular notion upon individuals, so they are swept along by the popularity and the enthusiasm of something. There have been manias over the years. For example, in Holland in the 1600s, the tulip craze, in which people were selling tulips at higher and higher and higher prices. They would buy them at a high price, knowing they could sell them to somebody else at a higher price, and suddenly the market collapsed, and that was the end of it. What had happened that was that people didn't ask, is this tulip really worth this? Because everybody said, this is the thing to do. This is the place to invest. Business Week pointed out in 1991 that if in January you had invested your money in any of the six companies with immune in its name, Immunex, Immunologic, Immunogen, Immunomedics, MedImmune, or Immune Response, from January to December, you would have had anywhere from 60% to 1,200% increase in your value. These, some of them had no earnings, but the name Immune indicated that this was obviously cutting edge and it was popular. But within 2 months of the end, each of those declined anywhere from 65% on down. The tulip craze repeated all over again. Now, the popular version of this, the term is momentum investing. The old slogan was buy low, sell high. This one is buy high, sell higher. I may be paying more than I should. I may be foolish to buy it. But somewhere, and this is the other term for it, the greater fool theory, somewhere there's a bigger fool than me. And I can sell it to him at a higher price. Ron Insana, in his little book, Trend Watching, Don't Be Fooled by the Next Investment Fad, says, at the market tops, all the fools have bought. So there's no greater fool to bail the other fools out. Now, the interesting thing is, we sometimes repeat the same thing. What happened? Why did people buy that? Because other people were buying it. Sometimes we buy into a theological idea or a church practice because it's the thing that everybody is doing. It's the popular thing. And instead of rationally asking, does this really make sense, we are swept along by enthusiasm. You can see it in other areas. You can see it in politics. Study a little of the history of Nazi Germany in the 30s. Watch those films of them singing what sound like hymns. Glorious things of thee are spoken. That's our version of it. But it was so designed as to develop that kind of mass psychology. Now it is natural for all of us to want to have something fresh and novel. Or at least in varying degrees all of us have that. We conservatives are at a sort of disadvantage because we believe that the sources of our faith and practice have been finalized 2,000 years ago, approximately. It's a little more difficult to be creative. How many ways can you find to say basically the same thing? It's much easier to be creative and fresh if you believe that Jesus was simply a human until the Council of Nicaea decided he was divine. Or if you believe that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and that they had children. Now, that's fresh and creative. But it is not an option for someone who holds to the authority, the limits the authority to the 66 canonical books. Sometimes we are swept along by a popular expression of something like this. Everybody knows that. Or it's negative version. Nobody thinks that way anymore. I suspect that some of the people that were responsible for leadership in changing the direction of this institution heard that a lot. That's an archaic way. Only dinosaurs think that way and so on. Alternatives are expressed as that's the X fallacy or the myth of Y, but without substantiation. Key terms or slogans add to the enthusiasm. The kingdom of God, community, realized eschatology, already but not yet, become what you are and so on. The suspension, because of the popular swell of enthusiasm, the suspension of rational, critical questioning. We need to learn from the mistakes sometimes that occur in the economic realm not to allow the same thing to happen to us in our theology. The further dimension of this, the tendency to short-sightedness or narrow-sightedness. One of the problems, if you've ever driven your car on a muddy road, you will appreciate the problem that was experienced in this country in times past before that, but especially in the 19th century, when people were trying to drive their wagons and their carts and their buggies on dirt roads. And somebody said, here's a wonderful idea. Someone in Russia has invented something called a plank road. It had become quite extensively used in Canada. And the idea was that you laid wooden planks along the road, and that formed a hard surface, one of the early forms of pavement, you see, and you could drive your buggy over that. Wonderful idea. Between 1847 and 1857, 1,388 plank road companies were incorporated in 17 states, and at least 1,000 plank roads were chartered nationwide. If you look at a map of the Chicago area, you'll still see in the west suburb of Naperville a street called Plank Road. They were everywhere. This was wonderful. People were investing in it. Caught up in the euphoria of the utility of this thing, certain other questions weren't asked. The investors, the promoters, assured the investors that the planks would last for at least 10 or 15 years before they had to be replaced. What turned out to be the case was the average life of a plank was 4 years. If your financial projections have been based on the idea it's going to last 10 years and it only lasts 4, you have an economic problem. The other difficulty was some potential difficulties were overlooked. No one thought about the fact that perhaps some of the horses that were being driven over this would have their hooves slip between the planks and would break their legs. But this was happening. There is a reason why you don't see very many plank roads anymore. But no one really thought ahead. We theologians are in danger of the same kind of thing, of one, thinking short range, and two, not seeing the difficulties involved in it. Liberal theology was very popular in the early part of the 20th century. In fact, the Christian century was the new name given to a publication because its publishers believed the 20th century would be the Christian century. Society would be Christianized. There was a belief in the positive character of human nature. People were basically good. There was an optimistic judgment about social progress. But then came some problems that developed. The Great Depression, beginning in October 1929 with the stock market crash. There were forces at work in places like Germany and Japan that would soon bring a tremendous war upon the world. And the Holocaust that was involved in that, the slaughtering, the destruction of people, especially of humans, it was difficult to maintain in the face of that the liberal belief in the basic goodness of human beings. What sounded good short term and without reckoning on the other factors turned out not to work too well. I taught, 4 years ago, a January term down in Baylor on theology and critical thinking. We had unique assignments like attending the Baylor-Purdue men's basketball game and observing the objectivity of the fans and things like that. And we had debates. But one student, we had debates. We had two teams of two each, and they were supposed to come prepared, not knowing whether they would debate the positive or the affirmative or the negative side. So they had to prepare on both sides. But one student argued for a particular position, and when pressed for the reasons for it, really couldn't give any reasons for it other than this has enriched my prayer life because I can now pray knowing that God, what God does will really be affected by my prayer. Unfortunately, he hadn't considered what happens when you pray to a God who doesn't know what's going to happen in the future and doesn't necessarily know what's the best thing to do in light of that. And I've recently observed a group of Baptists who strongly emphasize the priesthood of the believer, the sole competency, individual interpretation of the Bible, strongly opposed to any kind of official confession of faith. They had, of course, some unwritten boundaries, one of which was tested when they discovered they had a practicing homosexual in their student body, and they excluded him from the school and then found the gay community vociferous in their protest. It's great to say we don't have any confessions or any rules, but if you have them, you have to be prepared for the consequences of the unintended consequences of the acts. Consequences they will be, nonetheless. A fifth lesson, the failure to distinguish our business from our product. Or I should say the business's business from its product. There are ideas and products whose popularity has sprung up greatly. Some of you are old enough to remember Cabbage Patch Kids, Beanie Babies, Furbies, Pet Rocks, Pokemon cards. Some of you here are even old enough to remember attire referred to as leisure suits and Nehru jackets. Well, some of the companies that were doing some of these, manufacturing some of these things, are out of business. Some have had to file for bankruptcy. Because, you see, they didn't really ask what their business was. They were focusing on their product. To take it back a little bit farther, there were companies at the latter part of the 19th century that were in the business of manufacturing buggies. They thought their business was buggy making. That was their product. When a new product, the horseless carriage, came along, they went out of business. There were some other companies building buggies who recognized buggies were their product, but transportation was their business, and they adapted and they survived. Now, what we need as believers is to say, can we distinguish between the product and the business? The temporary form in which we minister, or even the particular style in which we worship, and the ongoing, unchanging, basic business in which we are in. You see, the product may change, but not the business. In theology, there was a movement called the Death of God Theology back in 1966. It burst upon the scene with great publicity. It made the cover of that great theological journal, Time Magazine. And for a while, I could have been busy every night of the week going somewhere to talk about the death of God theology. The demands, the requests came in, and then suddenly they didn't taper off. They went like that. They just stopped. The death of God had died. The theology was the death of God. And some theologians who'd thought that their business was the death of God failed to realize that was their product, and the product was dead. They were producing the wrong product, I would say, anyhow. Are we sufficiently sensitive to realize there are things that we do that are designed to carry on our business of evangelizing and discipling and reaching the world in a particular fashion with a particular product, but be prepared to replace that so that we continue in the business we were doing, but with another product? A further one, the treatment of those who challenge the consensus. Late in the 1929 bubble in our economy here, there were some people who expressed reservations that this can't go on forever. One was Paul M. Warburg, the most respected banker of the time and a founder of the Federal Reserve System. John Kenneth Galbraith describes the reaction. The reaction to his statement was bitter, even vicious. He was held to be obsolete in his views. He was sandbagging American prosperity. Quite possibly he himself was short the market. Economist Roger Babson also urged caution and received severe condemnation. More recently, in the 1990s, Alan Greenspan, when he warned about irrational exuberance, was ridiculed. Warren Buffett, who I heard on the news this morning, has now passed Bill Gates as the world's wealthiest man, said, "I don't invest in this high-tech boom. I don't understand it. I follow my old value investing system." time has proved he's done pretty well, and pretty well for his shareholders. By the way, he still lives in the same house in Omaha he lived in 1955, and the last I heard, he drove an 8-year-old Ford. So he doesn't live high on the hog. But here is a man who was made fun of because he wasn't swept along by this enthusiasm. When the latest theological fad comes, if you say, wait a minute, let's ask about this. Is this really biblically based? You will find there will be people who say, you are so out of it. You are so out of date. You have to get with it. It isn't easy to be what I would call a contrarian. Now, the word contrarian to some people conjures up the idea of someone who is sort of a curmudgeon. I mean, he's against everything. I think it was one of the Blooms who said, I am a Marxist, not Karl, but Groucho, who said, whatever it is, I'm against it. And that's the picture of a contrarian. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the person who says, if everybody thinks it's so, let's see. The odds maybe are pretty good they aren't so, because one of the rules of the contrarian is, when everyone is thinking the same, then no one is thinking. They are simply being swept along. I would urge a degree of caution. You see, the contrarian is optimistic when other people are pessimistic. The contrarian is pessimistic when other people are optimistic. And it means having the, in the case of the believer, having a strong enough relationship to one's Lord that one says, I am not going to be influenced by what other people say I should believe here. I'm going to be influenced by what the Lord has told me. I have been to Worms. I have not seen it, but a church history professor told me that he was directed to a spot in a garden where there is a plaque that says, here stand Martin Luther. Here Martin Luther stood. When he stood, as far as he knew, alone, and against all the force of the church said, I can do no other. Here I stand. Unless I can be convinced by Scripture and by logic, I must follow this. He didn't know whether anyone would stand with him, but there were those nobles who secretly slipped him off. And I've been to the place in the Wartburg Castle where he was hidden away and did his Bible translation. We might not be who we are today if there hadn't been a man who said, I don't care what the church says, I stand here because this is what God has convinced me of. Back in the 1990s, there was a popular television show, this is the economics of it, entitled Wall Street Week. And the host liked to have optimistic panel guests. He had one, Gail Dudak, who was the bear. She said, no, stock market's too high, it's going to go down. He got rid of her. As it turned out, she was the only member of his panel whose advice would have spared somebody from the crash that took place 2000 to 2002. To be willing and to be able to stand alone is a lesson to be learned from economics and a lesson to be applied as well in theology. Now, I want to draw together just one thing, one overarching thing from all of what we said in these several areas. In each of the disciplines, there is something that changes and something that is fixed. It was when Einstein observed that there was no addition of velocities of light, that the light coming from a star moving away from you came at the same speed as the light coming from a star moving toward you, that he said, well, light is constant. It must be that space and time are relative, and a whole new relativity theory broke through. It was when economists found what was the fixed thing. For example, the law of supply and demand. If there is more demand for something than there is a supply of it, the price goes up. If the supply exceeds the demand, the price goes down. That's why houses are cheaper now than they were before. That is an unchanging rule, really. What it applies to may change. Sometimes there is not enough oil. Sometimes, right now, there's not enough corn. The reason why your food prices are higher. Corn's going to make ethanol. The rule of supply and demand is unchanging, but what it applies to may vary. Something remains the same and something should change. About a year and a half ago, I decided we needed to replace some portions of the fence at our cabin. And it meant removing some rotted posts and digging new holes. And I was doing that by hand, and the thought struck me, they have invented a power post hole digger. So I got my grandson, who was then 14 and already started lifting weights, and I said, you know, this thing has two handles and a throttle and an auger on the bottom and an engine here. Grandpa's supposed to hold both parts, but how would it be if you held one part, one handle, and I held the other? He's got better thumbs than I have. Stronger, too. And so we proceeded to drill. And my wife said, what if you hit a rock or something that doesn't move? Well, I said, something will move. If the bottom of this digger doesn't move, the top will, and anyone or anything attached to it will also revolve. She was intrigued by the prospect of looking across the yard and seeing her husband and her grandson revolving. It didn't happen, fortunately. The right thing turned so that the other things could remain fixed. Let us be wise and discerning so that we do not simply try to preserve the way of doing things of another century. You can't minister, you can't reach the people who died 100 years ago. They're gone. Let us be prepared to change those things that should be freely changed. But let us be sure that we do not change the things that are fixed and unchanging and unmoving, that are based upon the unchanging Word of God and upon Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever. May God give us wisdom, and may God give us grace.